Succession number 27183, Reel 7.
Major Neave, Reel 7. You're saying that you the regiment was deployed east of the Orne, and you'd found a suitable place near Pegasus Bridge in an orchard, and you got yourself set up. What sort of preparations did you make to the orchard to turn it into a suitable location for our HQ?
Oh, very little. I mean, we dug holes under the tanks where we slept, and we were there for a sufficient long time to do that. I mean, normally there wasn't time to, but it was a very safe place to be if there were aerial or other shilling and that sort of thing. And you could get five chaps, you could get four chaps comfortably under the tank. And
what would happen to the fifth chap?
The fifth chap's probably on duty in the tank on the wireless anyway. And then you had stand two at first light. And everyone would have to get up and stand to their tanks. And,
Did you have any trouble with German attempts at infiltration or with stragglers or anything?
No, there were a few sort of alarms, but it never turned out to be anything. I think prisoners would come in occasionally.
You mentioned air attack. Did you see much of the German Air Force?
No, not a lot. Not a lot.
What about their artillery and mortars? Were they
We heard a bit of the dreaded Nebelwerfer, the moaning mini. There were some woods on the west, which the airborne were really more concerned with.
Will that be the woods? The woods in the west.
The woods in the east.
Oh, in the east. Would this be the woods on the Bavant Ridge?
No, they were the other side of the river, I think.
Yes.
Right there. But there were some woods. There was a bit of open land east of Pegasus Bridge.
Yes.
It went up, and there was a bit of open land. Yeah. And there were some woods beyond that. And I think the Germans had quite a bit of stuff in there. And the moaning minis used to come over from there.
Did they ever put down a concentrated bombardment on our HQ?
No, I don't know. It was desultory and occasional.
But were you able to camouflage the tanks?
Well, we were under these apple trees.
Yes.
We did put camouflage nets, of course, and we were pretty careful about our observation. But we were able to operate pretty successfully. It was from here that, of course, have I described my recollections of when Dick Harrop was killed?
You said that he went off on a reconnaissance rather incautiously, and that he didn't come back. But I don't think you went into detail about where he was going or what he was planning to look at.
Well, C Squadron were in touch with the enemy, and a troop had been told. I think it was C Squadron, it could have been A. And a troop had been told to go and deal with the situation. And it was a quiet morning in this orchard where nothing else was going on at that particular time, and we weren't required to go and do anything operational. And Dick Harrop said that he was going off to go and see what this troop was doing, and asked me to go with him. And I said, well, Colonel, it seems to me that this is a C squadron or an A squadron, I can't remember which it was, affair. And the squad leader's got the thing in hand, and the troop has been told what to do. And I don't see really that that's our affair. And I really must try and sort out the replacement tanks that we go to brigade and put in a bid because everybody would be wanting them. And unless we state our case pretty firmly, we probably won't get what we need. And Dick went off in a bit of a huff, actually. And he had to go through a lot of country which nobody had made secure. I mean, nobody knew what was there. And the Germans by this time were, I think it was the 21st Panzer, were probing forward all the time to find out where we were and where our positions were. And the whole ground between this forward squadron and us was very fluid and uncertain. And he went round a corner straight into a machine gun and was shot up and killed.
How did you hear about that? Was it? Did his driver get back?
His driver, I think his driver got to somewhere and they signalled it back to us. But I always felt very bad about it because I should have been with him, but it didn't seem to me that it was the best use of my time and said so.
Well, I mean, you were presumably as adjutant, if you were dealing with this kind of thing, you were the business manager of the regiment, in a way.
Yes. Let's think that I was the, as a staff officer, one was the sort of staff officer of the regiment. Mm. And it seemed to me that this lull in the quiet morning was just the time to go and sort this particular problem out.
Had you managed to get that sorted out?
Yes, I did.
The replacements?
I did. I don't think we got all the tanks we wanted, but we certainly got at least our fair share of them.
Where was this detached squadron then that was in contact? Do you remember the location?
I can't remember. It was somewhere down in the sort of St. Honorine area. Mm.
Presumably, so somewhere between St. Honorine and Escoville, that would have
that's,
been
that's the area. That's the sort of area.
What happened after the news arrived the colonel had been killed? How long did it take to get the commands restored?
Well, very rapidly, of course. Anthony Rugg Price came in from B Squadron.
Yes.
I think Peter Lahn took over B Squadron, and Sim Feversham took over command, second in command, took over command of the regiment. And he was extremely effective. It was a strange situation to find that there was this regular regiment, which highly professional, and I mean extremely professional regular soldiers being commanded by a territorial Sim Feversham, and with an adjutant who was equally a non-professional soldier. And I never ceased to admire and be grateful for the marvellous support that one got, realising that I realised only too well that I wasn't a professional and Sim wasn't a...
But by that time you had been in the regiment for
three years,
and
yes.
You had done a lot of training.
Yes,
presumably you were well versed in the practicalities.
Yes, I was, but I mean, it's rather different to being a dedicated professional. But I mean, I think they rose to the occasion, and this was the sort of occasion where it was vital that they should, and that Anthony Rugg Price, the second in command, was. He was immensely influential in guiding Sim Feversham in how things had to be done. And
Was that a normal thing in the regiment, that it, decisions effectively were really a matter of discussion rather than a single individual's decision?
Depended very much on the individual. I mean, Tom Milton Barrett was very decisive, he came from the Barrett of Wimpole Street, the famous martinet, and he had a lot of that characteristics in him. But as a commanding officer, he knew exactly what he wanted, he said exactly what he wanted, you knew exactly where you were, and I got on with him very well. He didn't, everybody didn't get on with him, but I did. Dick Harrop was a very different kind of person. He was much less precise, much more uncertain of them, but very much loved by the troops. They were all, he'd been in the regiment from the very beginning of his service, and was immensely popular, a frightfully nice person, but not an easy chap to be adjutant to, I didn't find.
Because his ideas weren't clear enough for...
A bit sort of woolly ideas, I found. And I mean, this business of going off to the watch the tanks launching never seemed to me to be his job, really. And this business of going off to see what this troop was doing through a lot of very uncertain country never seemed to me to be.
Do you think he had a sort of romantic temperament?
He was a very gallant chap, and I would think perhaps he did have that feeling that he had to be. I think that's probably
going forward and showing himself and inspiring the troops with presence is very much in the romantic tradition, isn't it? Of direct personal leadership at all levels.
He was a great polo player and a great sportsman, and I think probably that's right.
Well, did you have a sort of standard day, a routine day, when you were in that orchard near Pegasus? Were there things that you tended to do to a sort of schedule in the way of office work and so on?
I don't think so. You could never knew what was going to come up. I mean, you never knew at a moment's notice what was going to happen. So, I mean, were either frantically busy or doing very little.
Yes. So, were you then responding to crisis? Was it crisis management, as it were?
Because one hadn't got... you were sitting on your objectives, roughly speaking. You weren't supposed to be achieving something.
You're temporarily on the defensive.
Yeah, we're definitely on the defensive. Yes. We did move out at one stage when this counterattack was coming.
Yes.
Coming in. I think at a, it could have been, I remember, quite a long spell up on a fairly high promontory. I think it was when we were protecting the left or eastern flank of the Goodwood operation.
Yes, that came later on, though. That was July, wasn't it? 18th of July, Goodwood.
Yes.
But when this first counterattack came through, the one that Derek Wormald met,
yes.
Did you have any forewarning?
Yes, we did have a bit of... there was aerial reconnaissance had shown that this was...
So you at least had... It didn't come as a complete surprise. You were expecting them to try to do something.
No.
How long did it take, to beat off that attack? Do you have any notion of how...
It went on all one morning
into
the afternoon.
Did they manage to make any sort of penetration?
No, they didn't. No. In fact, they withdrew.
It sounds like they were just trying to feel their way.
I think that's right. I think
presumably they would have gone through any gaps they found to disrupt the defence positions. Did you see Derek Wormald's positions at St Honorine? Did you have an opportunity to go forward?
No, I didn't.
Do you have any idea of how you got them laid out? What sort of pattern the positions were in?
Difficult to say. I mean, I think some of them were in folds in the ground. Others were in housing.
They're actually in the village itself.
In the village itself, with concealed by behind houses and.
Because there is there's a chateau, I think, just to the south of the village. And there's another one with grounds on the road out eastwards towards Eskerville.
Yes, well now, which was the one where General Gale had his headquarters?
I'm really not sure about where his HQ was.
Because it was in that area. Mm. And on one occasion, he sent... he wanted to see Colonel and I, and we went down to see him. I remember very well they were just having lunch, and he said, I'm being troubled with snipers, and I wonder if your chaps could do something about it. And he took us through the back of this chateau, which wasn't all that badly damaged actually, into a greenhouse, sort of built on at the back. And as he went in there, a great flurry of bullets came in through the glass. And he said, that's what I'm worried about. And there was some thick woods and trees. It was all very enclosed right behind us. And we put down a blast in that and then carried it out.
Well, using tanks against snipers?
Yes. Well, I mean, it was a great thing was to put firepower down in every direction. I mean, you weren't economical with bullets at all. You blasted absolutely hell for leather as much as you could. And,
I mean, did the ammunition supply keep up with
demand? We were never for any length of time short of ammunition.
You were saying that Derek Wellmore's tanks were in somewhere in amongst the buildings, others were in folds in the ground. Had he actually done any digging to
I'm not sure. He could easily have done so.
I mean, it was done in some places, wasn't
yes.
it?
He would have had time. He would have had time to make pretty good bad positions.
I think you eventually moved out of that position on the east bank of the Orne over back over onto the west side to defensive positions there, just to the north of Caen.
Yes.
What was the intention there? Was that also holding the line, or was it?
Well, I think that was another preparation to try and capture Caen.
Yes.
But it was abortive, and I think it never got very far.
What went wrong with it?
I don't honestly remember. I don't think it was the great aerial bombardment. I don't really remember what...
So there was a big bombardment, I think, in early July, wasn't there?
Yes.
To try an Operation Charnwood, an attempt to clear Caen, followed by a fairly powerful
attack. The 56th Division, I think, was involved.
Yeah, they were involved, trying to advance in through the ruins.
Yes.
But, living in the field there, something you keep referring to is mosquitoes.
Yes. Yes. They were a perfect bore.
Was there anything you could do to protect yourself against them?
No, nothing. It was marshy land. I mean, it was the river was running behind us. And,
You also say some places that there were occasions during this phase when the the infantry didn't really get on as rapidly as you'd hope. But there are a number of occasions when the regiment attacked villages like Epron, Kuvrishev and so forth, that the tanks managed to go forward and get into the village, and the infantry didn't follow up. Do you know why that happened?
I think this coast country was terribly difficult for the infantry. I mean, the Germans concealed themselves everywhere. They were very good. It was an ideal defensive country. And the tanks, of course, had protection against the Spandau and that sort of thing, and against mortars, but the infantry didn't. And I mean, I think the ethos of the whole campaign was to have as few casualties as possible. It wasn't a sort of First World War charge and chair affair. And so, I mean, I think it was natural that when they got stiff opposition, they weren't forced, as it just to get on with it and take the casualties. I mean, I think that must have had some. I say that with hindsight, not not from the view that one had at the time.
Well, at the time, you expressed a certain amount of frustration about the fact
why they didn't get on with it. I remember that. But I mean, I think that it probably was absolutely the right policy in actual fact. But I mean, it was frustrating for us because we had this extra element of protection, which, in some ways that was not so, because these bazookas, which they were very effective, and we lost a lot of tanks through.
Indeed, in close country, every tree can hide a bazooka man, can't it? Yes. A number of times you seem to have gone off to visit Montgomery's headquarters.
Well, we had a troop which was specifically allocated to the defence of Montgomery. And we sent this troop over to his headquarters, which was way over towards Aramont, and then from there. And one had the feeling that if one didn't go and pay attention to it to see that it was getting on all right, one would have been, Monty would have said, well, you know, one of these people, they look after their chaps. And I mean, I think we wanted to be sure that they were being properly looked after.
Were they experiencing any difficulties with anything?
No, none, I don't think. And they had a futile row, which was a waste of everybody's time, I think. And they got a bit fed up, and eventually we were able to bring them back.
Were you able to rotate them at all?
Yes. Except, of course, movement in the bridgehead was incredibly difficult. I mean, talk about the M25 and traffic jams. Traffic jams on this unmade-up road. I mean, it was a purely it was a road that had been made by driving across country. it was an absolute nightmare. And on one occasion, coming back at night, Colonel and I, driving back, we took a wrong turning off this road, and we saw a chap waving a lamp, and we stopped him, and he was a French Canadian, and he said, the French Canadians were very brutal lot, and he said, I wouldn't go any further down this road if I was you, because we know in his Montreal French the Germans are in a couple of hundred yards further down there, and they wouldn't be very pleased to see you, he said, and produced a sandbag which was full of chopped off ears. They were bloodthirsty, you know.
Did you see anything else of, or anything more of them, the Canadians?
Off and on. We had our own. This was later on in the sort of time of the bulge of the.
Yes.
And we had our own affiliated Canadian regiment, which had the rather grandiose name of the 17th Duke of York's own Royal Canadian Hussars. And they were very good to us, because they always seemed to have very much better rations and everything else than we did. And we had come off the island, I remember, into the Reichswald, and for one reason or another, we didn't have any stuff at all, and they gave us the most marvellous breakfast, I remember, and topped up our rations, which they couldn't.
One thing you remark upon is how small Montgomery's headquarters was. What sort of scale was it? How many tents would there be in his and caravans?
Caravans. Four caravans, I would think. And a whole lot of staff cars and scout cars. And that was about it.
What sort of place was it in? You mentioned it was west of Arromanches. When you went to see it?
In a very undistinguished, it wasn't in a great big chateau, it was in open, relatively open country. I seem to remember with a few trees.
Was it camouflaged? Did they have scrub nets?
It was camouflaged, very, very heavily, very much camouflaged.
Did the troop ever have occasion to do anything to defend it?
I don't think they did.
What was their role? Was it to guard the headquarters against an armoured attack?
Yes, it's a very small headquarters.
Yes.
And against any sort of attack, I think. Mm. I mean, the infiltration of a sort of thing like a long range desert group, which the Germans could have organised if they pinpointed Monty's headquarters. Mm-hmm. They could have organised a sort of parachute drop or something of that sort. And their job was to deal with that.
Did he take a personal interest in the troop?
I think he did take a reasonable interest. I mean, he went to see if they were all right. And,
did you actually see the man himself at any stage?
I didn't, no. No. Not at that stage, no.
So presumably he was out then when you went calling on HQ.
Yes. But he had this team of liaison officers, who, a bunch of bright boys who would go off in scout cars or motorbikes all over the place and come back and report to him every day. And that's really what the headquarters consisted of.
Montgomery himself and his LOs.
And his LOs and his chief of staff, I suppose, and his, perhaps not his chief of staff, but some element of his ADCs and things.
Did the LOs come down to regimental level?
Yes, they did. Not very often, but one would see them from time to time. But I don't think they're ever... Their role wasn't so much to identify themselves as to sort of go and find out what was happening by contact and visually seeing.
He called them his directed telescopes.
Yes. I think it was all a good system, actually. I think they were pretty bright boys.
Well, it's a very old-fashioned system, isn't it, having ADCs and gallopers going out to investigate specific questions and report back, sort of thing that Marlborough would do.
Yes. But of course, Monty had, they all had wireless sets.
Yes.
He can tell them.
You mentioned also going around Bayeux and actually going into Bayeux on one occasion.
Yes.
And having an indifferent meal at Lion d'Or.
Yes. I can't remember quite. But I also remember seeing that in the cathedral,
yes,
full of people, absolutely full of people. And they had a shop where you could buy socks and things, an officer's shop. It was pretty useless.
Did you often find places were open where you could go and eat, or was this very much a rare occurrence?
Very rare, very rare. Mm. No, very. I mean, I don't remember any other occasion of going to anything like that.
How did you normally organise your feeding at RHQ? Did you
cook
by tanks?
Each crew did it. And you had a pack, 14 men for one day, or one man for 14 days. I mean, it was any variation like that. Why